Mini episode 588 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to mini episode number 588 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here. We have a very special treat for you today on the show where nothing is off topic. I always love when we who hold ourselves up as the show with hopefully the greatest breadth of conversation anywhere can live up to it with consecutive guests. Of course, mini episode number 587, speaking with former Congressman Joe DiGuardi, one of our resident in-house political analysts, to break down the Republican presidential debate. We are going to a completely different subject today, looking primarily at the National League races as they are materializing with a gentleman who has seen them all up close from covering the Atlanta Braves on a regular basis, a third-generation baseball broadcaster, a legendary broadcast family, of course, grandfather Harry Carey, father Skip Carey, and this gentleman who was with us on episode number 65 of the show, July 15th, 2009, before we were even doing the mini episodes of the show like this. It's a pleasure to be able to welcome him back to the show. He, of course, covers the Atlanta Braves, broadcasting games for Fox Sports South and for Sports South. I speak, of course, of the one and only Chip Carey. Chip, it's an honor to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure's all mine. Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you on. Let's take a look first at the Atlanta Braves, of course, that you're seeing on a regular basis here covering all of their games. A trade recently between the Braves and my Cleveland Indians, which is very, very interesting as far as what it says about the pace of rebuilding, I think, for both teams here. John Hart, the common denominator, a longtime executive here in town with the Cleveland Indians. Clearly, the Braves look to be trying to clear the books for 2017 with the acquisitions of Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne. Really a financially-oriented trade, much along the lines, it seems, of what we see in the NBA on a regular basis, where it's a balance sheet kind of a deal, maybe as opposed to on the field. The Indians getting back Chris Johnson, who from the Braves' perspective, they're glad to get him off the books for 2017 with the new ballpark. Your thoughts on that move and what it says about where the Braves are going?
Well, I think you hit it all on the head. There's really not much more I can add to that other than the fact that both general managers felt that they had sunk costs, and it was about how to maximize the value or the applicability of those sunk costs to maximize the direction in which both franchises are going. The Braves get financial flexibility after the 2016 season, which is when they really feel they're going to make a big push as they get ready to move into their new ballpark. The Indians get salary relief starting next year, which is what they want to supplement their ball club and try to get back into the thick of things in the central race. From a baseball side of things, Nick Swisher gives Atlanta a veteran guy who's a rah-rah guy, as Indian fans well know, and that's great if you're playing well. If you're not, it can probably wear on you, which I've read has been the case. And I've known Nick a long time, and I think he's as genuine as they come. But for us, too, we get Michael Bourne back. And quite frankly, Michael Bourne's a guy that never should have left. He turned down a one-year qualifying offer that the Braves gave him. They were concerned about signing a 30-year-old outfielder to a long-term contract. Instead, Frank Wren, for some reason, decided that B.J. Upton was going to be an upgrade. And that turned out to be a tremendous disaster for this team. So we get Michael Bourne back, who's a great guy, great leader, great guy in the clubhouse. Arguably a big reason why Jason Hayward had his best year in the major leagues. They were like peanut butter and jelly together in our locker room. And while Jason Hayward is gone, Michael Bourne's another veteran guy who knows how to play, plays the game the right way, is enthusiastic, is positive, and can really help nurture what is right now a very young clubhouse, at least as far as our pitching is concerned, and some of our young players is concerned as well. So, yes, this was a financial deal. But in some ways for the Braves, too, it was a baseball deal because we believe, and John Hart believes, you can't have too many character guys in your locker room. And we feel like we added two more in Bourne and Swisher. And, you know, that's no secret. Chris Johnson wasn't happy here. He was a square peg in a round hole. He wanted out, and the Braves obliged him.
Well, as you pointed out, regardless of what anyone may think at the time, history is not going to smile kindly upon the decision to forego Michael Bourne for B.J. Upton. Be that as it may, again, you look at Bourne and the way that he played in the couple of weeks before the trade, and you don't have to squint very hard to see how he can be useful to Atlanta, even as a fourth outfielder, worst-case scenario, if he kind of tails off again. Curious to know what you think about Swisher, who his biggest problem has been staying healthy enough to play, period, in a league where there's the DH. Opportunities will come few and far between playing for the Braves there when they visit American League cities. But what are they thinking is going to be the case the rest of the time here? Maybe get him back at first base once in a while? I can't believe you'd ever want to put him in the outfield again.
He's been playing first base with Freddie Freeman out. Our first baseman's on the DL with an oblique problem. Freddie also missed a month with a bad wrist. So Nick has played first base, I think, let me get this right. I think he's played first base two out of the last four mm-hmm. games, something like that. He DH'd once down in Tampa Bay, so it's three out of four. The Braves might try him in the outfield, but again, that depends on how the knees feel. We know what his limitations are, and frankly, when Freddie Freeman comes back, I would imagine Swisher, if he can't play the outfield, is going to be a guy that comes off the bench and pinch hits. So that's his role, and for now, that's his fate with us. Where that leads him after the end of this season, only time will tell.
Well, he's a very positive guy, and I certainly can't observe from his time in Cleveland that he's been accountable for poor performance. And, again, that would seem not to be a guy who's going to gripe about reduced playing time if, in fact, he doesn't deserve more than what he gets. So that should be very interesting to see how that plays out. I want to go to something that I noticed on your Twitter feed. You retweeted something. I'd like to get your opinion here. You see in the National League East this gentleman quite a bit, Jacob DeGrom, some statistics that ESPN was quoting that you had retweeted. What's your observation right now about where he slots in the game? The consensus seems to be, whether it would include this year or not, that Clayton Kershaw is still king of the hill, although Zach Greinke's certainly been right on his heels from his own clubhouse. You got a couple of obvious suspects when you're talking about the best in the game. Has Jacob DeGrom done enough in two seasons to where you think he should be in that conversation?
I like track records more than I like flashes in the pan, and I mean that with no disrespect to Jacob DeGrom. Let's see what he does 2-3 years down the road. I mean, remember a year and a half ago, Matt Harvey was going to never lose a game and win Cy Young Awards every single year, and he got hurt. So, yeah. Look, let's be honest. John Smoltz, who knows more about pitching than I ever will even forget, feels that Mets rotation is better than the big three in Atlanta. Who am I to argue with that? They certainly are pitching like that. They have a lot of talent. They're young. They're hungry. They're good. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch and see how the Mets limit their innings like they promised they would do, a la Steven Strasburg with the Nationals a couple of years ago. The Mets are very careful about the long-term futures of those guys, but they are racking up big amounts of innings right now, and they've had to, and it's helped them build a 3.5-game lead in the division. But I think that's going to be a fascinating thing to follow with DeGrom and Syndergaard and Matt Harvey, Steven Matz, a side problem or a lat problem that's put him on the disabled list. When he comes back, he's a guy that could probably plug in and make some starts for the Mets and let those guys go to a six-man rotation, assuming he's healthy. It's not up to me to anoint guys as being the best in the business. I think the record speaks far more eloquently than I ever could. You mentioned Kershaw. You mentioned Greinke. Nobody's pitching better than Kershaw right now. Greinke's having a great year and an opt-out year. It's tough to beat those two guys, 1-2 in rotation. So until the Mets' big three has done it consistently, I defer judgment to those who've actually pitched. And I defer to the records, too, and the pattern. And Kershaw is certainly tough to beat right now.
Absolutely, yes. And after that rough start earlier this year, you had to expect a progression to the mean from him. And he has certainly delivered that, as you noted. And as far as the Mets go, yes, I think a lot of people would probably agree with John Smoltz, particularly when you're looking at the depth of the rotation vis-a-vis what the Braves had back in the day, because Steve Avery was there for a few years, but then not really on the back end of the Braves' run. So in terms of going 1-5, I think what John Smoltz said certainly can't be disputed. But that leads me to, in the same division here, if we're going to be looking at National League races here, let's stay right there. A team that is going to have an awful lot to answer for if they can't, at a bare minimum, make it as a wild card and then make a pretty good run from there. The Washington Nationals, a lot of people's pick to make the World Series, myself included a year ago, not this year. For whatever reason, I was on St. Louis, and that's looking pretty good right now. But Washington, they're making a lot of people kind of look red in the face that picked them there. On paper, nobody has better talent in the league than them. What's been their story as far as being able to get run down by the Mets, a team that is so inferior to them offensively on paper?
Well, right now, I think the biggest talent, and I say this with all due humility and respect to the Nationals, the biggest talent they have is going to the disabled list. They just can't stay healthy, and that's horrible news because they have talented guys that just keep getting hurt. Rendon has not been right all year with his leg problems. Zimmerman's had the plantar fasciitis problem. Escobar's missed time with injury. Bryce Harper's got a knee that sort of cropped up before Zach Greinke and Clayton Kershaw pitched, interestingly enough. Denard Span's missed about a third of the season with his bad back. Steven Strasburg has been out. So in fairness to the Nationals, they really haven't had their lineup together or their team together for more than one game, if even that, in 2015. So, one, you got to cut them some slack on that. But, two, all I keep reading and all I keep hearing is that the Nationals say it's their division to win. It's their division to lose. It's theirs. They're the best team. Well, okay, show me. They've got 50-some-odd games left to show the rest of baseball that that's the case. But right now, the Mets are playing better. And quite honestly, I believe that in certain degrees, the Nationals' claim of all the injury woes rings a very, very hollow. When you think about what the Mets have dealt with, no David Wright most of the year. Michael Kadire has missed time. No Travis d'Arnaud, who's missed a couple of months with a bad elbow. Zach Wheeler has been gone the entire year for them. Lucas Duda has been up and down in the lineup for them all year. Daniel Murphy has missed time. They really haven't had a great deal of good play at shortstop for themselves all year long. They lost their closer not once but twice to PED suspensions this year. Bobby Parnell is just now coming back from Tommy John surgery. So with all due respect to the Nationals and their claims of superiority and their claims about, well, injuries have been the issue, the Mets are just as beat up as they are, and quite frankly, the Mets have played better. The Nationals aren't scoring runs since the All-Star break, and they trail by 3.5 games, and I think it's going to go down to the very final week of the season. Remember, the Nationals' final week of the season ends on the road. They have to play the Braves 4 games in Atlanta, and you know the Braves would love nothing better than to wreck their season. And if memory serves, their final 3 games come on the road at Citi Field in New York against the New York Mets. So the Nationals really, really have a tough row to hoe here over the final 5-6 weeks. And I have a great deal of respect for their players, their manager. Mike Rizzo's a friend of mine. But right now, quite frankly, the Mets are just playing better than they are.
Yes, they are. And I believe what you said is true as far as Washington and the lineup not being intact, maybe even for a game this year, when you look at Rendon being down starting at the beginning of the season and what has materialized since then. So it's been quite a run of bad luck for them. At the same time, they've had a story there that really does sort of illustrate the difference between baseball and other sports, doesn't it? That being the emergence of Bryce Harper to a level where, again, a couple of years ago when he was getting mentioned in the same breath as Mike Trout, at that point it was mostly just hype. This is the first year that it's actually materialized as far as being a fair comparison between the two, and yet sort of the equivalent of what Steph Curry did in Golden State. But you can't elevate a lineup single-handedly in baseball, and isn't what Harper's doing sort of the proof of the limitations of even when you get one guy going at that level, if you've got enough other chaos and injuries around him, what kind of a bad situation it can still be?
Well, he carried him for the first couple of months of the year and was putting up, MVP-type numbers in the first half of the year, and it's tapered off, as you'd expect, since then. Look, I'm a big Bryce Harper fan, as a fan of the game. I love watching the guy play. I think he's enormously talented, and when he does what he does on the field as a fan, I think it's just great to see, even as a Braves fan. What bothers me at times about Bryce Harper is it seems like at times he only plays hard when he wants to play hard, and that's unfortunate. I feel like I get cheated as a fan or a paying customer, which I'm not, but as a broadcaster, I want to see those guys play hard all the time, and I think that's the difference between Bryce Harper and Mike Trout. At least the perception is Trout plays all out 100% of the time. For the Angels, sometimes Bryce Harper peels off on a route, doesn't run hard, takes a night off here and there, and whether that's immaturity or not, that's the perception that people have around the league about him, and it's unfortunate. I don't know that it's particularly completely and totally 100% well-founded or based in fact, but when Bryce Harper plays like Bryce Harper's capable of, it is a beautiful thing to watch, and as a fan, I love to see it even when he does spectacular things against the Braves. And I hope that as he grows up and matures, he understands that if he plays hard every night, I hope he adopts the Joe DiMaggio mantra. He played hard every night because there was someone in the stands who may never had seen him before or may never see him again. And that's the lasting impression Joe DiMaggio wanted to make. And if Bryce Harper does that, he will have a brilliant, brilliant major league career.
Very well said, and again, there is a real contrast there right now, unfortunately, with Mike Trout in that regard, in that Mike Trout might be rocking the Pete Rose haircut, but he's also rocking the approach to the game as far as going all out every time there. We haven't quite seen that out of Bryce Harper yet. Looking at it right now, it would seem like Washington, well, they certainly would be on the outside looking in vis-a-vis the wild card race. Are you of the sense that the National League East is probably only going to send one team to the postseason when you've got Pittsburgh, when you've got the Cubs sitting there, certainly San Francisco, even though it's an odd-numbered year, we still can't rule them out somehow. Are you of the sense that the NL East might be limited to one team?
It looks that way unless they beat each other up, you know, unless those central teams just beat the you-know-what out of each other over the final 6 weeks, and somehow somebody tames the Cardinals. The Pirates couldn't do it this past series in St. Louis. Pittsburgh's a really good team, but they're hurt with Harrison out, with Jordy Mercer out. Gerrit Cole was human last night. He pretty much has to win every time out if the Pirates are going to put together a long run with those two key injuries. The Cardinals are amazing. Their young pitching is outstanding. They make the right moves seemingly every year to get what they need to get. Matt Carpenter moving to the leadoff spot has really improved their lineup. The Cardinals are a terrific team. And everybody knew the Cubs' young talent was very good and on the come. And I think the Cubs in this way are a great template for what the Braves are trying to accomplish. The Braves have stockpiled their system with pitching. The Cubs have stockpiled their system with hitters. And I think that's there might be a natural trade partnership there in this offseason for both of these franchises to try to get a little of what each other has to strengthen their ball clubs. But I said earlier in the season that I felt that the Cubs, after the All-Star break, once 70, 80, 90 games were under the belts of some of these kids, that they would start to take off if they were for real. And they've done that. They've rattled off 12 out of 13, something crazy like that. Obviously, they can't gain any ground on the Cardinals in the division, but they're gaining ground in the wild card race. And those young guys are playing confidently. They've got good pitching. They've got a good bullpen. Their manager thinks outside the box. And with all, again, respect to the young players, they don't know any better. They just go out and play. And having worked in Chicago with the Cubs and knowing what a playoff race is like in Chicago, there is a lot of energy that young and old players alike can feed off of. And, it would not surprise me to see to see the Cubs in that hunt in the National League all the way down to the bitter end. And we head to Chicago here in about a week and a half, looking forward to see the Cubs and the new ballpark and the newness of the ballpark at Wrigley Field, I should say, and how those kids play before their home crowd. They didn't play real well in Atlanta, but, the Cubs are for real. They're going to be good, and they're building a monster on Chicago's north side. So the rest of the division would best be on its toes in the National League Central.
Absolutely. It's been an incredible run that they've had this year. And, again, I think baseball fans everywhere can kind of think wistfully of how much your grandfather would enjoy calling a year like this for them, the way that they've been going. And you mentioned about how the minor leagues, how they've been stockpiling on hitting, and yet they've had just enough on the pitching end as well here too. Arrieta looking like an elite guy at times here. Jason Hamill, I say this as a grateful fantasy owner, having a career year there somehow or another. So, it's an interesting balance that they have. And, again, how much do you attribute Joe Maddon being there to part of the equation? Obviously, they didn't have nearly the amount of talent in previous years. They had made some strong moves in the offseason to upgrade the major league talent as well as promoting guys. But in terms of being a difference maker, with all the talk in the game the last couple of years about the strategic moves of him, everything Bruce Bochy has done, in San Francisco, how much of it do you lay at Maddon's feet? That's a guy that I know a lot of people, including one of our in-house analysts, Steve Callis, is labeled as the best manager in the game.
I'm not a big analytics guy, but I understand why people think what they think. Ultimately, computers don't win you games, players do. And if you don't have good players, you can have the best computers in the world and the best analytics and stuff, you're still going to lose more often than you win. And Joe Maddon is no dummy. As I said, he was smart enough to know that the situation in Tampa was not going to be as good as the situation in Chicago, and he had the contractual right to opt out of his deal and go to Wrigley Field in Chicago, where the Cubs have passionate ballpark, great fans, sellouts every night, big TV contracts, all the money in the world to go out and do what they want to do. To the Cubs' credit, this transition, the fruits of it are being borne out now. You must recall, 4 or 5 years ago, the Cubs were awful. They were losing 90, 100 games every year. And the reason for that was they had to take the foundation of that franchise down to the studs. They totally cleaned house at the major league level, totally cleaned house at the minor league level, drafted, developed, and stayed the course and worked very diligently and very patiently, knowing that a franchise that hasn't won in 100 years and they had the ability, because Theo Epstein came over from the Red Sox, to say, give us 5 years. It's going to take us 5 years to get this right, and when we get it right, we're going to take off. That takes some gravitas to be able to pull off. And when I was in Chicago, the fans weren't patient. The organization wasn't patient. The Tribune Company wasn't patient. And I think historically, if you look back at the Chicago franchise, impatience is a key part of their problem. They would change managers every two, three years, general managers every 5, 6 years, and there was never really much organizational consistency to develop a plan, vocalize a plan, and stick with that plan. So, yes, Joe Maddon is very smart. He's a terrific manager. I love watching his work. He also knows that he's got a lot of talent there, and smart guys go where the talent is. You don't see many guys go manage rebuilding teams at this stage in their careers. Joe Maddon has been there, done that with the Rays. I think the Cubs were a perfect place for him to land and a chance for him to try out his philosophies on a very big, big stage with a very, very big, bright microscope on him and his ball club. And so far, they're coming through with flying colors.
Absolutely. And everything that you're saying about organizational patience and staying with a plan, observation could be said of my Cleveland Browns since 1999, or my Cleveland Indians prior to the Hank Peters, John Hart era, when they finally committed to something and built with it.
That's really a product of our society now. It really
yes.
is. And, you know, we are the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, instant information, 24-hour news cycle society. People don't want to sit back and evaluate and wait patiently for the plan to be implemented. If the plan doesn't work in a year and a half, well, automatically the manager stinks, the first baseman sucks, get him out of there, fire the general manager, bring in somebody new who can win right away because fans want to follow a winner. I get that. But that's not realistic. It's like having a baby and asking your newborn baby to be diaper trained in 3 weeks instead of 9-10 months. I mean, that's just not
yes.
how life operates. And I think that those of us who follow the game have an immense sense of frustration when we, again, see a plan, understand the plan, and in midstream see that plan uprooted and changed because of the blowing winds of public opinion. It takes some organizational courage to have patience, as Clint Hurdle has said. It takes organizational smarts to be able to develop a plan that's rational. It takes a lot of money to stick with that plan and know that you're going to go through some lean years. In the case of the Braves, we're going through one now. But it is part of a process, and if you reward the process by letting it develop, then you can see at the end of 2 or 3 years where you are. Then you can make adjustments on the fly. But for a lot of years in Chicago and a lot of other places, the wheels came off the wagon the first time they hit a speed bump, and that never works. And I think that's borne out by, again, as I said, the last Cubs championship in 1908.
Well said. And there was at least a little bit of fan impatience in Chicago coming into this season. I bet those folks are red-faced right about now looking at the year that the Cubs have had. I want to ask you, you referenced Clint Hurdle there and in an earlier breath about analytics. Certainly the Pirates have been one of the teams that have really embraced it and done very well with it. But as you mentioned earlier, again, failing to make up the kind of ground on St. Louis to seriously challenge for the division. It looks as things stand now, their best-case scenario is going to be another play-in game. And I can tell you, with my best friend being a Pirates fan, what kind of frustration there is in the fan base. This flip of the coin wild card game, the Pirates will be the poster child for that with 3 years of playing in that game there. That might be the perception out in the fan base if here we go again. Is there a lot of danger of that seeping into the clubhouse facing a scenario like that, lose and go home?
No, I can't speak to what's going on in the Pirates clubhouse because I'm not there.
Sure.
I would say to the fans that feel that way or the players who feel that way, well, consider the alternative. Do you want to play a one-game playoff for a chance to go on, or do you want to sit home and watch somebody else play it? I mean, that's pretty simple. At the end of the day, get in. Most of at least in recent history, the teams that have gone in as the wild card representative have gone on to win the World Series. So if you can get in, you take your chances. And if I'm the Pirates and I've got Cole or I've got Liriano available for that one-game playoff, I feel pretty good about my chances of having a good shot to winning the game. But ultimately, you got to get there, and the alternative isn't so good because that means spring training in Bradenton in mid-February for pitchers and catchers.
That's true, and I will say, too, it does seem to favor teams that are a little bit more deep in terms of starting pitching because I know for myself and anybody else that got sucked into thinking the Indians might win the American League this year, the thought was even if you make it as a wild card, you still got the other big three in the rotation. So, as you said, the Pirates have a little bit of depth there to where they're not going to be handicapped by not being able to throw their ace in game one of the divisional series if they make it past, because they do have a little bit of a cushion in that regard. Team that knocked them out last year, and again, the bane of the rest of baseball in the even-numbered seasons recently, San Francisco Giants, making a heck of a run, staying with the Dodgers, and again, this has become an old story of being competitive with and many years superior to a team that really has it all over them in terms of talent on paper. Your thoughts about that rivalry out there with the Dodgers and the Giants this year, San Francisco staying close on their heels, and what the last month of the season might look like?
My personal opinion with regards to the Dodgers and Giants, with the exception of the pitching staffs, is the Dodgers have the players with biggest names. The Giants have the better team. I love the way the Giants play. Hunter Pence is one of my favorite players. Great guy, super talented, does everything. The most unorthodox player in the game, but really knows how to play. Gregor Blanco and Angel Pagan in center field get it done. Nori Aoki's done an excellent job leading off. Brandon Crawford is maybe the most underappreciated shortstop in the National League. Matt Duffy ought to be in the first couple of names as far as the Rookie of the Year is concerned in the National League. Joe Panik is out with a back problem. I think the Giants have a great chance to maybe go get Chase Utley. That would be an awesome deal for them. Brandon Belt is a guy that the Braves tried to draft and sign, couldn't. He's hitting the ball out of the ballpark. And the best catcher in the game is Buster Posey. So from a position player standpoint, the Giants are an outstanding team. They just don't score enough at home because their ballpark isn't conducive to the way that they like to hit. Madison Bumgarner, what else can you say about what he did in the playoffs last year? I really like Mike Leake. I think Leake is going to be a big addition when he comes back from his hamstring issues. Matt Cain's coming back from the tendon issues in his elbow. He had bone chips and couldn't straighten out his elbow. Once they got those taken care of, he could actually straighten the elbow out and started pitching again, but that inflamed all the tendons because all that stuff got stretched out because his arm was straight again. So if that threesome is in order, that's a pretty salty group. You've got Tim Hudson who could pitch, Tim Lincecum who could pitch, in rotation again. Chris Heston has a no-hitter for them. I'm a little concerned about the back end of the Giants' bullpen with Casillas' issues and Romo and his 8 million sliders that he throws. But I really like the Giants' ball club. The Dodgers, look, if you get Zach Greinke and you get Clayton Kershaw, you got your hands full. But if you look at Clayton Kershaw in the playoffs, he has not pitched well. I think he's way below 500 with a 5-point ERA in the playoffs. That's very surprising. The Dodgers struggle to score runs. Their bullpen is an issue. Avilon and Johnson, the guys they got from the Braves, have not pitched well for them yet. So getting the ball to Kenley Jansen is going to be an issue. Yasiel Puig, is he going to be a star? Is he going to be a goat? Don't know. They have a crowded outfield. Turner's been great at third base, but he's been hurt. Who's going to play shortstop? Who's going to play second base? Is Jimmy Rollins going to get anything done? I mean, there are a lot of question marks with that Dodger team, other than, if you got Greinke and Kershaw, you only have to score two runs to probably win the game. And if that's the case, that's a big leg up for Don Mattingly, in my opinion.
It certainly is. And the case with the Dodgers as well, something that they've had in common with Detroit in recent years, who is also in the minds of many kind of underachieved once they've got to October, it's been that bullpen. The Dodgers, of course, being cognizant of that, making the upgrades to try to behave the way to get the ball to Kenley Jansen a little bit smoother. Thus far, things not going very well there in the bullpen for them. So, again, some very talented guys, though, that they did acquire. So for L.A., and again, we're all kind of, as is the case with a number of these questions, kind of speculating from the outside looking in. But given the amount of commitment that there has been towards upgrading this club, the moves made, whatever, one would think that it's going to be a very, very difficult offseason for the Dodgers if this is another year where they end up not getting it done, or at least not even making it to the National League Championship Series.
Well, it'll be difficult in one way, and yes, it would be a very bitter disappointment if they didn't get in the playoffs and they didn't go far because they have the highest payroll in baseball. But that is eased by the fact that the Dodgers this year are paying $87 million for players who don't play for them. That's more than the payrolls of six teams. So from that standpoint, Andrew Friedman has the ability to go out and write a check for whomever he wants and use money as what it is, currency. He can spend whatever he wants luxury taxes be damned, to go get the players he wants to get and fulfill his roster and put together the team in his image if he so desires. I think they've got to figure out what to do with Puig. I think they've got to figure out what to do with Carl Crawford. They've got to find another guy or two behind Clayton Kershaw, because Zach Greinke, I think, is going to opt out of his deal. He'd be silly not to. That's why getting Alex Wood was insurance for them this offseason for the Dodger ball club. But, yeah, I mean, I don't feel bad at all for the Dodgers in this regard. They have more money than anybody in baseball. They are the modern-day Yankees. They have a huge TV deal. They draw 3.5 million fans per year. They have the greatest broadcaster in the history of the game in Vin Scully. They're going to be fine. They're going to be able to spend whatever they want to spend and use dollars as the ultimate currency to fix whatever needs fixing. And they've shown that they've shown their willingness to do that even now with this neck-and-neck fight with the Giants out west.
Absolutely. And, again, when you look at him, we talked about Theo Epstein before, everything that he did in Boston prior to coming to Chicago. It was, I think, very reductionist for people to have said, well, it was money ball with money, but he was implementing some of the processes of Billy Beane and doing it in a situation where there were more resources. And when
ultimately money is money. But again, if you're throwing, sure. if they want to give me $80 million to pitch, that's not going to be a very successful strategy. It does still have to be based on sound baseball principles. And I think the Dodgers are doing that, but they're operating like a big market team should. They have the dollars, they have the fan base, they have the ability to go out and pay top dollar for the guys they want. And because of the atmosphere and because of all that LA has to offer, they can truly get the cream of the crop. But that doesn't mean just going out and writing checks. That means getting the right guys who can handle all of that opportunity brings. And I think there might have been some situations where that didn't work out. Case in point, Hanley Ramirez. You know, the Dodgers are run by extremely smart people. They are, a marvelous franchise, great place. And when they're good, it's good for the game. It's good for the game of baseball. But right now they have a lot of eggs in the air, it seems to me, and that they're not further ahead is not just a condemnation of the Dodgers or their players. It's really a credit to the Giants and what they've been able to do out west.
Exactly. And right now, as you said, they have a tremendous payroll. Some of it is being used inefficiently as far as paying players who are not there, like Matt Kemp. It's a temporary situation for a year or so where they're having to do this kind of stuff. But if you look back, of course, at the teams that made the NLCS in 08 and 09, that was powered by a great run at AA Jacksonville, I think about circa 2005 or so, that great crop of players that was coming through there at that point in time. So is there real reason for the rest of baseball to shudder, as I sort of draw the parallel of Theo Epstein in Boston here with Friedman in L.A., because one would think, at least on the surface, imagine what the Dodgers can do when their payroll is not so inefficient as it is now. It seemed like that would be a very, very scary thought for the rest of baseball.
Yeah, but it's funny. People talk about that with the Yankees in the 90s when they and the Braves were locked up in all the playoff races. It's, well, the Yankees, all they do is go out and buy their players. Well, if you think about the core of the Yankees, Jorge Posada, homegrown Yankee, Tino Martinez, he was acquired, Bernie Williams, homegrown Yankee, Mariano Rivera, homegrown Yankee, Andy Pettit, homegrown Yankee. So the core of the Yankees team was farm system guys, and those players were supplemented either via free agency or trade. Let's look at the Dodgers. Very similar. Jock Peterson, homegrown Dodger. Yasiel Puig, homegrown Dodger. Clayton Kershaw, homegrown Dodger. Kenley Jansen, homegrown Dodger. Seager, the kid in the minor leagues, the big hard-throwing pitcher that just came up and pitched for him, homegrown Dodger. So, as long as your core is your homegrown talent and picking where the Dodgers are picking every year, kind of like the Braves, is a testament to their scouting and development people, it's not easy to do that. They've drafted and developed very, very well, and the players that they don't think can fit in with them, they've used to trade away to get what they wanted, a.k.a. Hector Oliveira, who was traded to the Braves for Alex Wood and Jim Johnson and Luis Avila. That's what farm systems do, but you have to have talent. The homegrown talent is what drives all of it, irrespective of how much money your franchise has or can spend. And for years, the Dodgers have been one of the best in baseball and probably still are at drafting and developing and signing players in the U.S. and internationally and getting them to the major leagues. And that's a huge, huge benefit, a huge tip of the cap. And you're right, when they weed out some of these bigger term contracts that they took on when they went for it, the Dodgers truly will be a monster out in the National League West.
That will be a very, very frightening prospect. And, yeah, you talk about the homegrown guys that go, that went through there. And I go back to, again, 2009 when they made that that run in the playoffs and having Tommy Lasorda on the show just prior to that and asking him the question, do you think that he's going to have a run like Josh Beckett in 03 for you guys to win the whole thing? And I was delighted when he didn't take the politically correct answer of, oh, we can't put that much pressure on a kid. And he said, well, that's what we're going to need from him. And that was basically, yeah, well, I think he was right in that regard.
Yeah, when you check the price tags of these guys, if you're being paid like a number one, pitch like a number one. And Clayton Kershaw is pitching like a number one. Zach Greinke is pitching like a number one. It's number three and four and pitcher, you know, sixth inning, seventh inning, eighth inning guy that I think the Dodgers have to figure out. But as I said, Don Mattingly is a smart guy. Rick Honeycutt's a smart guy. They'll figure it out. And, you know, it would not surprise me at all to see the Dodgers involved very, very seriously in the National League postseason race.
Yes, I think we're all looking for that, and it's going to be very, very incredible to watch, especially, again, with the stakes involved, with the expectations mounting over the course of the last couple of seasons. One of the most intriguing stories to watch as we go into September and then subsequently October as well. But, again, as anticipated and certainly as was the case last time around, Chip, a tremendous conversation. I want to thank you so much for being on. It's always great to get the very talented multi-generational broadcasters on here, like five-time lounge guest Kenny Albert. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys who have it in your blood and understand the games so well. Tremendous insights. Love to do it again with you. Thank you so much for being on with us today.
Pleasure's mine. We'll enjoy the last 6-7 weeks of the season, and we'll talk soon. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Chip. Thank you for being on with us today, and thank you, everybody, for joining us to listen to mini-episode number 588 of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.